This is Intersection, I'm Matthew Petty. The hugely complex plan to restore the Everglades made progress in 2021, but Florida's environment and wildlife faced some big challenges too. Environmental managers are now taking drastic steps to try and stop manatees dying off in massive numbers. For more, we're joined by WMFE environmental reporter Amy Green.
Thank you so much for joining us.
It's my pleasure.
Manatee mortality is a big story this year. Now, you broke some news recently about supplemental feeding of manatees. What exactly is it and how is it going to help these creatures?
That's right, Matt. So the wildlife agencies just announced they are going to start supplemental feedings for starving manatees in the Indian River Lagoon, specifically at the Cape Canaveral Power Plant in the Indian River Lagoon, which is a warm water habitat for manatees during the winter months, which is when manatees are most vulnerable because they are sensitive to cold water. And so the wildlife agencies say they are going to provide romaine lettuce for the manatees. And this is not a decision the wildlife agencies take lightly. This is a very serious and a very significant step that the wildlife agencies are taking in response to a record die-off this year of manatees in Florida. More than 1,000 manatees have died. Mm-hmm. And the epicenter of this die-off is the Indian River Lagoon, where widespread water quality problems have led to a loss of seagrass, the manatee's favorite food. And so this is a somewhat controversial decision. It's a needed decision, I think many of the advocates would say. But usually the last thing you want is for a wild animal to be dependent on humans for food. Feeding manatees without a permit for individuals still is illegal. This is a very unusual step and a very unusual response to a serious problem.
Now, you've been reporting on this issue for months now. When did ecologists realize that there was a bigger than usual problem with manatee mortality?
Yeah, it became clear there was a problem in the Indian River Lagoon about this time last year when there were a series of cold snaps. And again, manatees are sensitive to cold waters. And so what can happen in the Indian River Lagoon is that when a cold snap occurs, manatees are faced with a crucial choice. They can either stay where they are and potentially starve because, again, there's been a widespread loss of seagrass in the Indian River Lagoon, or they can forage elsewhere and freeze. And so about this time last year, the agencies that are engaged in rescues and recoveries began noticing an uptick in the number of distressed manatees they were seeing. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, again, during the winter months, that's when we saw the most mortalities in this die-off this year. And that's why the wildlife agencies are working so urgently to prevent another die-off this winter. And that's one of the reasons why they're doing these supplemental feedings.
Now, you've done quite a lot of reporting, Amy, on environmental restoration projects. One which hasn't received as much attention as the Everglades is the Kissimmee River. Just remind us what that project involved and why 2021 marked such an important milestone in that ecosystem.
Right. So this was a very significant milestone this year in Everglades restoration. A large restoration of the Kissimmee River reached completion. And, you know, a lot of people describe Lake Okeechobee as the watery heart of the Everglades. You might describe the Kissimmee River as the backbone of the Everglades. The watershed begins in central Florida with the headwaters of the Kissimmee River. And then, of course, the Kissimmee River carries that water to Lake Okeechobee, and it flows south through the River of Grass from there. And a century ago, the Kissimmee River meandered very slowly back and forth from central Florida into Lake Okeechobee. And that river has been drastically altered to drain the peninsula and make way for development and agriculture. And that's caused a lot of environmental problems. And so so what they did was basically restore those historic meanders of the Kissimmee River. And the goal is to improve water quality, both in the Kissimmee River and in Lake Okeechobee. Again, it's a significant step forward for Everglades restoration, which is composed of dozens of restoration projects, which each on their own are massive projects, and one of them is the Kissimmee River.
One of the stories you reported on this year, Amy, was about the rights of nature, and this was a push by local environmental activist Chuck O'Neill. What made this attempt to strengthen environmental protection so unique?
So this is just a fascinating movement by a group of environmental advocates. And what they're aiming to do here is kind of turn the environmental movement on its head in a way. And rather than, you know, putting more regulations on polluters, which advocates like Chuck O'Neill argue allows them to continue polluting one way or another, they want to establish legal rights for nature that effectively make it a violation of the law to pollute water bodies. Here in Orange County, by a margin of nearly 90%, voters approved a charter amendment implementing this rights of nature concept. And earlier this year, we saw a lawsuit. It was a first-of-its-kind lawsuit in the nation, actually, brought on behalf of five Central Florida water bodies that are, incidentally, tributaries of the Kissimmee River. And the lawsuit was over a proposed housing development in the fragile wetlands. And the lawsuit argued that the development violated the waterway's rights to exist and flow freely without pollution.
One of the stories that you reported on for NPR and with Inside Climate News, Amy, was about greenhouse gas emissions from landfills. What was the takeaway from your reporting on that issue here in Central Florida?
So the project that we looked at with Inside Climate News was methane emissions from landfills. Methane is a very potent greenhouse gas, and many experts believe that immediate reductions in methane emissions are the best way to slowing climate change in the near future. So with Inside Climate News, we examined the amount of methane coming from landfills and found that some of the biggest polluters were right here in Central Florida. But we also found that the numbers were squishy. Estimating methane emissions from a landfill is complicated. You can't really capture methane emissions from a landfill because landfills are obviously vast areas and can emit methane from various points. And so landfill operators use a series of equations and modeling to estimate those emissions. And we found that the equations and the models were inconsistent and in some cases inaccurate, including at one of the landfills here in Central Florida. And just to follow up on this story, we just learned this month that some environmental groups are informing the EPA of plans to potentially sue over these equations and models because the environmental groups claim the models underestimate methane emissions.
So a complicated story, and I think your reporting really sort of shed some light on a pretty serious issue, but one that isn't maybe so well understood. There's been some changes politically or in statewide environmental leadership. One person who stepped down was Noah Valenstein. He stepped down this year as Environmental Protection Deputy. What was his impact on environmental leadership in Florida?
So we're seeing a lot of changes recently in Florida on the environment when it comes to our government leaders. As you said, Noah Valenstein stepped down earlier this year. He had been doing a dual role as Secretary of the Department of Environmental Protection and Resilience Officer after the former Resilience Officer had left only 6 months into the role for a position in the Trump administration, and she left early in 2020. And so we now have a new secretary at the Department of Environmental Protection. We also have a new resilience officer whose name is Wes Brooks. You know, it's a transition for Florida when it comes to our government leaders on the environment. And it also comes at a time when DeSantis is, I would say, showing some change or showing some transition in his stance on some environmental problems. He, of course, has made the environment a central issue of his administration. And you and I, Matt, have talked a lot on this program about all of the money and other initiatives that he's put toward Everglades restoration. When it comes to climate change, Florida's biggest environmental problem, He has done a lot less. He was pushing a bill during the legislative session this spring that put money toward resilience projects in coastal communities. But he's done less on issues like clean energy. And so this has been a, you know, kind of a point of contention for a lot of environmental advocates who point out that Florida, you know, is a state that is very uniquely vulnerable to the hotter temperatures and rising seas and more damaging hurricanes that are associated with climate change and burning fossil fuels. And yet the state doesn't have any kind of statewide clean energy plan. And so we just saw him this month kind of touting some of these resilience projects that he, you know, has been pushing for coastal communities, but at the same time avoiding words like climate change and talking about global warming as something, as he put it, something people use words like global warming, he said, as a pretext to do, in, again, in his words, left-wing things. And he says, again, in his words, we're not going to do left-wing stuff. So, you know, I think what we're seeing is, you know, some shifting in DeSantis's comments and stance on the environment in Florida.
And amongst all of this reporting on bigger projects, there's also some reporting you've been doing on some of the wildlife in Florida. The grasshopper sparrow seems to be doing better.
That's right, Matt. So some good news to celebrate when it comes to Florida's environment and, you know, in 2021, which has been another tough year for a lot of people. The Florida grasshopper sparrow is a very critically endangered bird in North America, the most endangered bird in North America, and it's found only on the Central Florida prairie, and that's the only place on the planet where it's found. And the grasshopper sparrow has been the focus of an urgent effort to prevent its extinction. And so what the wildlife agencies have been doing the past couple of years is breeding Florida grasshopper sparrows in captivity and releasing them on the Central Florida prairie. This was another decision that was not made lightly. The last thing you want to do is take critically endangered animals out of the wild so that you can breed them in captivity. But they had an opportunity to do that with some birds that were found in a flooded area without a mother, and they were rescued, and they started captive breeding the sparrows. And just within the past few years, they started reintroducing those sparrows to the Central Florida prairie. And the sparrows are thriving. And, you know, when they started doing this, nobody knew how the sparrows would do. Nobody knew whether the sparrows would know how to breed in the wild and feed themselves. And they've figured it out, and they're thriving. And the wildlife agencies say that population now is beginning to stabilize, which is great news.
Life finds a way, right?
Yes. Yeah, that's one way to look at it.
Well, Amy Green is WMFE's environment reporter. Thank you so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
It's nice talking with you.